And now,
great to be back.
Back to the Bill Frank Radio Show.
Awesome.
And your host, Bill Frank.
Welcome back. Here's a riddle for you. What do you get when you put three economists in a car with a GPS system and a mission to interview small business owners? You get a book. In this case, Roadside MBA, Backroad Lessons for Entrepreneurs, Executives, and Small Business Owners. We'll explore some of these lessons with one of the book's co-authors to see if academics can apply economic theory to small business realities. Paul Oyer is the Fred H. Merrill Professor of Economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and a President James K. Polk fanboy, as we learned in the book. Paul has a Ph.D. in economics from Princeton University. He met his co-authors Michael Mezzo and Scott Schaefer at Kellogg School at Northwestern University. Joining us from Stanford, welcome to the show, Paul. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being our guest. Thanks for writing the book. You know, when I first heard the title of this book, I was struck by the YouTube channel that Jerry Seinfeld has set up that's called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And I thought, oh, here we have economists in cars visiting businesses.
So we got a lot of coffee on the way as well. So.
I noticed that from reading the book. Caffeine is what powered this more than gasoline, it turns out. So tell us, how did you come up with the ideas for a road trip to visit small businesses throughout the USA?
Well, we'd been taking road trips voluntarily as a group for a few years before this. So we had a tradition where when the three of us were at an economics conference, we would just to sort of get away from the conference and do something different, often get into a rental car and go somewhere an hour or two away just to get there. Typically, this was to visit a state we had never been to because we all wanted to be able to say we'd been to every state or something like that. But and so that was the road trip side of things. As far as the small business side of things, we're all strategy professors, and we think about markets and holes in markets and how they can be filled. And we felt like there's a lot of small businesses out there that where the people who run them and own them don't have the time to try to invest in an MBA or other types of courses where they can learn the frameworks we're teaching in our business schools. And we wanted to find a way to provide that information, make these small businesses a little more aware of the types of ideas that are going on in business schools and elsewhere. And somehow that came together into a road trip for economists.
Well, it turned out it's a very interesting read and very approachable. I like the combination of factoids about you and the other authors, as well as the visits to the businesses. But
thanks.
The big question in my mind was, how did you select the small businesses that you were going to visit? I mean, of the millions, well, actually it's thousands of small businesses throughout the United States, how did you select the ones that you visited?
Well, that was a little bit of happenstance and a little bit of planning as well. So we would typically call the local chamber of commerce in a city we were going to visit and get ideas on who they thought would be interesting people to talk to, who had a good story to tell, and so forth. So it wasn't as scientific as some of, if we did a research paper, we would have been much more scientific about it. This was just, we were looking for illustrations of concepts, and we wanted people with an interesting story to tell who might work that way. We began at certain points to say, you know what, we haven't spoken to a business of this type, or we need a few more businesses that are smaller or bigger. So we began to be a little more targeted as we got on in time, but initially it was just, who did we think would have an interesting story to tell? And usually we were right. You know, occasionally we'd go in and we'd talk to somebody who wasn't as exciting or as interesting, but often we would go into a business thinking, oh, this business is such and such, something sort of seemingly mundane. And inevitably, we would get excited by talking to this person and be really happy we'd chosen a seemingly mundane business.
Well, I would have to agree with that. The businesses that you feature in the book, there may have been more that you visited, but the ones that are in the book each had a very interesting story and each had a very interesting niche. Now, the flip side of that question is, okay, once you figured out which businesses you were going to go visit, how'd you get the owners to take time away from their business to sit down and to talk to you, particularly about the finer points of their business?
We were really worried about that question, and it turned out not to be something we needed to be very worried about.
Why so?
People love, many people, I wouldn't say everybody, but many people love to talk about their business. They've poured their hearts and souls into this, and they think about this all the time. And to have three people who are there and really fascinated by what they're doing and want to hear their story and maybe put in a book, that's very exciting for a lot of people. So we didn't typically have trouble finding enough people in a given town who were happy to talk, take an hour out of their day and talk to us about it.
Okay. Well, now, you did visit many, many small towns. In fact, it's predominantly small markets that you went and visited. Why did you choose small markets, and how did that influence the book? I mean, would the book have been different if you had gone into small businesses in large metro markets?
I don't think the book really would have been different. I think the basic ideas in the book apply just about anywhere. I don't think that the fact that it was in small towns made a huge difference in terms of how the book worked out. The reason we did it in small towns is, first of all, we like the idea of the road trip and so forth. The other thing is, if you pick a small city, it's easy, just logistically, it was easy to spend one day and get around and see all sorts of businesses in that particular town and not have to worry a great deal about traffic getting from one. If you're in Liberal, Kansas, it's not that hard to get from one side of town to the other. So just logistically, it worked out quite well for us.
I imagine that is true. My guest is Paul Oyer. He's one of the co-authors of Roadside MBA. Paul, just to give us some framework, what was the balance sheet of the largest business that you visited through your road trip and the smallest business that you visited in the road trip?
Now, we didn't see their balance sheet, so it would be easier for me to put it in terms of employees, if you don't mind.
That'd be fine.
We went to one company that had about 600 employees. They were, the vast majority of them were at a headquarters in near Cincinnati. This was a large maker of fryers for the fast food industry. That was the biggest. They were a one-time small business, so they kind of qualify. Typically, though, the outside of what we were talking about was about 200 or 250 people. The smallest business we visited a furniture store that was really pretty much just the founder and one part-time employee.
Okay, so it really covered the gamut there. And just to make your point a little bit more emphatically, if I can, remember that every big business started out as a small business.
That's a very good point.
Well, now, the main thesis of your book is what you all call Mazzo's Law, named after one of the co-authors of the book, Michael Mazzo. And the law is this, that the answer to every strategic question is, it depends. Now, on the one hand, I like that because the law is not too rigid or too inflexible. But on the other hand, it sounds a little bit like economist mumbo-jumbo to me. So, Paul, if you will, explain Mazzo's Law.
I think if you look at most small business advice from people, they will typically be a list of five things you need to remember to succeed in business, or five great ideas that will double the size of your company or improve your marketing or something like that. We basically reject that way of thinking about business advice. I mean, you can be very selective. If I have this particular problem, I might be able to pare it down into five things I need to remember. We're strategy professors, and we think in the bigger picture, how am I going to be successful? The answer is you have to be successful by thinking about what works in your particular business. So how am I going to be successful? The answer is always it depends on the things that are involved in your particular marketplace, on the things you are particularly good at doing, and so forth. And so just basically, any generic business advice, that's too easy. Everybody else can do it. Your competitors can do it and so forth. What we think helps set businesses apart is to say, okay, what am I good at doing? What is a niche out there, or a hopefully big niche out there, that I can succeed at and that I'm better at other people at approaching, and to which there aren't barriers to keep me from doing it and so forth. So we've tried to keep things relatively simple, but at the same time think about the big picture. What is going to make me successful, and how can I think about where my place in all of this is? And the answer is different for every single entrepreneur or small business person out there.
Okay, Paul. I mean, you've sold me on that basic idea, but the trick to Mazzo's Law is knowing what it depends on and correctly identifying it. Because if you're a small business, you don't have a lot of latitude for mistakes. And if you incorrectly identify what it depends on, you could be down the toilet. So how do the successful business owners hone in on exactly what it depends on?
Yeah, trial and error is a simple answer to that. You have to try various things out and see how they work. And people make, you know, we heard a lot of stories about people who had made mistakes along the way before they figured out. They either underestimated the cost, they had some great idea and they underestimated the cost of doing it, or they had some other great idea and they found out that the demand for that idea wasn't as great as they thought it was, or that hiring the right person for that wasn't going to work. And so, you know, they adjust along the way and find out what does and doesn't work, what they are truly good at or not truly good at. That's why we aren't going to tell you, hey, do this or do that. We're trying to help you think through, okay, what are the frameworks around which I want to think about how to be successful? And then I want to target my my individual trial and error, if you will, to finding what works in my particular business.
Very good advice. My guest is Paul Oyer. He is one of the co-authors of Roadside MBA, Backroad Lessons for Entrepreneurs, Executives, and Small Business Owners. And Paul, as I was reading through the book, one of the things really struck me was this conflict that came up in my mind reading two of the chapters. At the very beginning of the book, you've got a chapter titled Scaling a Business. And at the end of the book, you've got a chapter titled Competing with the Big Boys. Now, as I see it, small business owners are being forced to differentiate and to stay small so that they can undercut these big businesses. In other words, do what the big businesses can't. So here's my dilemma with these two chapters and with the whole thing in general is, how can a small differentiated business grow large without fearing that these larger competitors are going to move in and crush them?
I don't think they can eventually. So you're at a certain point, you become successful enough. If the company is successful enough at being differentiated, eventually it's going to grow some, catch some attention, and maybe then problems develop in terms of competition. And so, well, the answer to this is, as always, it depends. So let me give you a couple of different examples from the book here. We talked to a company down right outside Atlanta called Prodo, and it's an excellent business. They make misting systems. I don't know if you go into the supermarket, if you've ever noticed, every once in a while some water will start pouring down on
all the time. I seem to be reaching for something just as that mister goes off.
Exactly. Well, you know, somebody makes those misting systems. And these guys figured out a way to make those misting systems a little bit cheaper. And for a little while, they had a nice little niche, and it was coming along. And then at a certain point, they had to face the facts that their competitors were going to pour in and start creating problems for them. But they had built their business around scaling up very quickly, and they had solidified a different sort of a way of being different in their misting systems that was very hard for the big boys to adjust to. And eventually they carved out a really large share of this market, which they still hold to this day, by sort of building up slowly and doing things differently in a way that the other guys couldn't do. So they were able to sort of get in there, build their critical mass, build barriers to entry because the technology, they had run in a new technology, and then scale the business and take on the competition. Now, there are other guys out there, and there are a ton of businesses we talk to who are never going to scale to that level. And if they did, they probably would get crushed. So we talked to a guy who runs a sporting goods store in Columbus, Indiana. Beautiful, nice sporting goods store downtown. And he has only one store, and it's pretty successful. Well, the key to his business is he knows his customers so much better than Dick's Sporting Goods would or something like that, that he's able to offer products at just the right moment. So he knows when football practice will start at the local high school. He knows when all sorts of things. And the incentives just aren't there for the Dick's Sporting Goods manager to figure all these things out and try to fight him on that type of business. They just go after selling other sort of sporting good products at scale. Well, if Mike Bodart, who's the owner of the small store I mentioned, wants to get big, he's going to have to give up his competitive advantage. And so on the one hand, there are certain types of businesses like Prodo that can scale and eventually have to worry about taking on the big boys and maybe aren't in a position to do it. And then there are a lot of businesses we talk to that just won't quite ever be able to scale to the level they might want to, because that would take away their competitive advantage.
My guest is Dr. Paul Oyer. He is one of the co-authors of Roadside MBA. And Paul, I'm glad you brought up some of these smaller businesses, particularly the ones that won't scale, because one strategy in your book, Roadside MBA, that I didn't see addressed was exit strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of these businesses were great for a living for the owner, but they were a little more than a job. You mentioned the sporting goods store. There's also a great example of a coffee shop in Portland is another example of there.
Yeah.
But the problem is they've just bought themselves a job. The big payday comes when the business is sold. And since most of these businesses are small, how does the owner position themselves to actually exit the business and have that big payday?
Well, I don't know that they're ever going to get a big payday. I think the big payday was having a job they really loved for a long time. And so, you know, Mike Bodart loves the life of running that store. And someday, sure, hopefully he'll sell it and get a reasonable return on his investment. But in the meanwhile, he's enjoying, the return on his investment is that he has this great job that he really likes and, you know, comes into every day excited about. And when he walks around town, everybody's like, hey, Mike, how's everything going? I mean, that I think is the payoff for him. And someday, sure, hopefully he'll sell the store for more than he bought it for, but he's not going to get rich. And the same is true of the coffee shop owner who you mentioned. Business is called Silk Espresso, very nice high-end coffee store, which is excellent in certain ways, and she's making a very nice living for herself, I imagine. But there are limits to the scalability of what she's doing, and when she goes to sell her business, she'll hopefully get a nice return on her investment, but she's not going to do as well as Mark Zuckerberg, and she accepts that.
All right, that's good. My guest is Paul Lawyer. Paul, I'm going to throw away the script right now. I'm going to ask you to pull back to 30,000 feet for just a minute, because Bloomberg this week sent out a chart that showed business investment from 1960 to today. And the chart's very revealing because it skyrockets in the 60s and the 70s, then business investment plateaued throughout the 80s, and as you might imagine, it nosedived starting in about 2007. Since small business is the driver of real growth in the economy, based on your interviews, when are small business owners going to begin to invest again, invest in people and invest in plant, property, and equipment?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the way the economy has moved, there's a lot of returns to scale have developed over time. Technology has helped businesses manage from afar, for example. So as an example, we interviewed a guy who has billboards in Illinois. Well, he's been very successful because he has a lot of local information about how to set up billboards and so forth. And over time, his competitors have been able to do some of the things from afar and at a bigger scale that he could only do by being local, because they have better technology for monitoring the quality of the boards than they used to have, and because they have GPS and traffic things that tell them exactly where to plant these boards and so forth. So over time, a guy like that is fighting against the fact that technically it's now sort of more in the interests of this business to be larger than it used to be. And that's true in a fair number of businesses. And so I don't know that we're going to see an uptick overall in small business. We're going to see that there are still niches that they can fight out with the big guys. But I don't know that there's a change, a reversal of the trend or anything like that. Having said that, when I think about this from an economist perspective, the incomes in the United States have gotten much more unequal over time. And as a result, we have a lot more of an upper class with a lot of money to spend. And those people might be looking for very personalized services where, again, small businesses are going to have a particular advantage in servicing those. So high-end restaurants would be one obvious example, but there are many others one can think of.
Concierge doctors and the like. My guest is Paul Lawyer. Exactly. He's a co-author of the book Roadside MBA. And Paul, one of the many personal factoids that we learned about you in the book is that you're a President James K. Polk fanboy. So my question, I'm just puzzled by this. I want you to know. But my question is, you know, why Polk? Because there were many other presidents who were more economically focused. There were other presidents who were more small business friendly. Why Polk?
Well, that's a random thing from my childhood. For some reason, when I was 6 years old, I was having an operation. I think I was having my adenoids out, and somebody gave me a book of all the U.S. presidents, and I just became obsessed with them from the age of six. And James Polk, in particular, caught my attention a little while back because he's kind of a forgotten president. He's considered by most historians to be one of our most successful presidents of all time, but very few people even know who he is. So I just sort of got very interested in him, and it turns out we were very excited to visit Slidell, Louisiana, one of the towns we stopped in on the way, because James Slidell was an emissary sent to Mexico by James K. Polk. So that was a nice tie-in as well.
All right. So now we know that you're a James K. Polk fan because you found him remarkable as a president. I want to bring you back to the book, if I can, for just a minute. Of the 40-plus businesses that you visited for this book, which one was most remarkable to you and why?
Well, that's like asking which is your favorite child. They were all so remarkable in so many different ways. But I do have a sentimental favorite, and it was Arnold Tool and Die in Council Bluffs, Iowa. It was the head of the company, the founder and the guy who runs it, is a guy named Jim Hackett. Jim was the first person to agree to interview with us, which alone is is enough to make him our favorite, make us realize this might work after all. But the other thing is, we went to visit his machine shop up in Council Bluffs, and it was 90 degrees and 90% humidity, and the place isn't really air-conditioned, and it's noisy, and it's not a particularly comfortable place in which to work. But it was just fascinating. Jim, he's in a manufacturing business, and everything is against him in some ways, you might say, in manufacturing in the U.S., right? The scale economy, he doesn't have the scale economies. He doesn't have the low cost structure and so forth. And over the years, he had just sort of figured out how to hone in more and more in the niches in which he could be successful relative to other big companies. So he was basically very high, over time, going to very high-skill, very specialized products, meeting the needs of larger manufacturers. And we just found it fascinating to see how he had managed to do this and change his business and evolve it over time with the overall changes in the manufacturing economy.
My guest is Paul Oyer. Paul, who should read your book, Roadside MBA?
We have in mind everybody who owns a small business or would like to own a small business. So if you have a restaurant or a dry cleaner, that's great. If you have a small factory with 100 people, we hope you're going to find things in there that are going to be useful for thinking about how you're going to grow, whether or not you should grow, what are the ways to beat your competition, and things like that. We also think any aspiring entrepreneur will find some valuable insights in there to think about what are the businesses they should get into, how might they approach thinking about whether they're going to have barriers to entry or face barriers to entry. So any small business or somebody thinking about starting a business, I really hope they would find something in here that would make their business a little more efficient.
And Paul, what did you get out of writing Roadside MBA?
Well, for one thing, I've now been to all 50 states, so that's...
Hey, congrats.
That's a minor personal accomplishment. I think visiting all these small businesses was so exciting as an economist, because we sit around and we talk about theories of economics, and we study empirical facts, and just to go out and see how all the ideas we're putting down on paper in theory and how they play out in practice. And first of all, it was somewhat rewarding to find that our theories do work really well, but then to get some sense of which things really were important and which things weren't as important, it was just a great learning experience.
Ah, that is great. My guest has been Paul Oyer, one of the co-authors of Roadside MBA, Backroad Lessons for Entrepreneurs, Executives, and Small Business Owners. Paul, if you've piqued the interest of some of my listeners, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go?
I'd go to our website, roadside-mba.com.
Roadside-mba.com. Paul, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on The Bill Frank Show. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thanks very much for having me.